What I wanted to talk about was the Bodhisattva ideal or the Bodhisattva path, and this is an ideal that they have in Buddhism that we have that is one of the more beautiful ideals that Buddhism has to offer. The Bodhisattva is the literally means sattva means a being, usually translated as a being, and bodhi means awakening. So a bodhisattva is an awakening being, and awakening means that the person is not totally awake yet. And it also means that's one meaning of awakening being, and the other meaning of awakening being is that it's a person who helps other people awaken. Helps other people wake up. And because the Bodhisattva ideal is the ideal of a person who's not preoccupied, solely involved with that person's awakening for themselves, but is also interested in supporting and helping other people in their awakening and their becoming free and being free of suffering. And this ideal of the Bodhisattva is often associated in Buddhism with Mahayana Buddhism, which is the Buddhism of Tibet, of China, of Japan, of Korea. And it's considered not to be the important ideal for Theravada Buddhism, which is the Buddhism of Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma. And it's a kind of a misunderstanding. It's kind of an unfortunate division to associate the Arhat ideal with Theravada Buddhism and the Bodhisattva ideal with Mahayana. And that actually both ideals are held in both traditions. And that the Bodhisattva ideal is a pan-Buddhist ideal that's existed in all schools of Buddhism. And what's historically true is the Mahayana Buddhism emphasizes it almost exclusively. Whereas Theravada Buddhism tends to emphasize more the Arhat ideal, but the Bodhisattva ideal is found in it, and it's a very important part of it. And that there are many Theravada Buddhists who pursue the Bodhisattva ideal. So just say that it's a Buddhist ideal. It doesn't belong to any particular school of Buddhism, this particular ideal. And so I'm talking about an ideal which is different than usual the way Vipassana teachers talk, because the emphasis in Vipassana is in talking about what's actual more than what's ideal. And there's a hesitation, I feel, at least within myself, to talk much about ideals, because ideals get us into big trouble. We compare ourselves against an ideal, we measure ourselves against an ideal, we strive to attain an ideal. And ideals tend to kind of... The danger in ideals is they take us away from what's actually happening in the present moment. And Vipassana is, if nothing else, it's the practice, the Buddhist practice, which is about really waking up to what's recognizing what's actually happening in the present moment. And we know better than anybody, because of our attempts to do this, how ideals get in the way. And so I say sometimes that rather than, if you're stuck between the ideal and the actual, let go of the ideal and really pay attention to what the actual is, get to know the actual, and develop as much compassion and understanding for what's actually going on, rather than using some ideal to beat yourself up with. And the tremendous faith that I have, and that I think that Buddhism has, is that your whatever ideal Buddhism has to offer can be found through deeply respecting the actual, what's actually happening in the present moment. You don't have to turn away for something. You don't have to strive after something else. You just have to really wake up fully and totally to what's actually here, all the warts and all, even when it's unpleasant, the unpleasant sides of it. And it all comes with time. The ideal will come. However, the ideals... So there's often hesitation to talk about ideals. But ideals also represent our potential. And sometimes it's very valuable to have some discussion and some images of our potential, some sense of that there's a potential that greater, we have a greater potential than what we're in touch with right now. or that we have some sense of some potential that we have, or we've touched it at some point, we've tasted it, we know that it's true, it's a true potential that we have, and that this is something that's valuable to explore, to develop, to move towards in our life, and not simply just leave it to chance. You know, I'm going to be with the actual and let it kind of be the chance that this ever reappears. But actually we can move ourselves in a certain direction based on our potential, and we can be inspired by potential. Part of the function of ideals, the wholesome possibility in having an ideal, talking about an ideal, is that it can awaken within us, it can inspire within us that potential we didn't know that was there. And so if we never talk about ideals, if we never talk about potentials, we might actually not, you know, always, if we're always talking about the actual, we're going to always be talking about the five hindrances. Yeah. You know, and that's all fine, you know, but to wake up and to be inspired in the possibility, to be inspired of what's already within us, we don't usually see, is part of the function of ideals. So in mindfulness practice, it's very much about waking up to what's actual. And as I talked about this morning, it's beginning to see the difference from living a life based on aboutness versus a life that's based on direct experience of what's direct participation with our experience as it is. To participate in our experience is a lot different than having an about relationship. You know, this is what it's about, and so we kind of removed ourselves from it, and we're analyzing it, we're reacting to it, we're having judgments or opinions about it. And rather than having judgments, opinions, fears, hesitations, confusions about what our life is about, we can let go of all that, and we let go of all that, what's left? In Buddhism, that's defined as awakening, when all the fears and hatreds and aversions and confusions fall away. But what's left is a sense of participation, and you can't maybe even talk about, it's very difficult to talk about this sense of wholeness, a whole sense of experience, which appears when the divisions of hate and aversion and desire and lust no longer seems to be kind of creating a division or obstacles. Aboutness is a world of objects. You know, we objectify the world. And the world of holistic experience no longer objectifies the world. And we find ourselves, we are the world in a sense. And this is where we talk funny language sometimes. We talk about we are our experience. We are the sound. We are, you know, the flower that we're looking at. We are the wind blowing across our face. We are the person that we meet. We are the homeless person that we meet. I don't know if I should say this, but I'm not saying this to kind of, sometimes I shouldn't talk about myself so much, and I don't say this to kind of to point out that I'm, you know, anything good about me particularly. Just an example. I'm not a very generous person, so I just say that first. But this guy came up to me on the other day at downtown Palo Alto, and he asked me for some money to buy a hamburger at the McDonald's there they have, or Burger King, McDonald's right there on University Avenue, Burger King, and so I gave him 50 cents. I had my and then I said, well, why don't I buy you your burger? Because I knew I hadn't given him enough to buy a burger. And so he looked at me and said, well, okay, I trust you. So, okay. So I went over with him and bought him. I said, buy whatever you want. And he said, he ordered a cheeseburger. And I said, well, is that all you want? And he said, okay, I'll get a prize too. But it wasn't like I was thinking of being, I was being generous. It wasn't like I thought I was being generous or I was trying to be generous. It was like, oh, can I, you know, I'll just buy this guy his dinner. It was like, it wasn't like I was trying to. It wasn't like, no one should, you know, think I was generous because I did this thing, because it wasn't generous. It was just like, oh, you know, I don't know why it occurred to me to do it. I gave him the money. That's what he wanted. And I just kind of did it. You know, we went over, we talked for a while, and I bought him his dinner and left. it wasn't about anything. It wasn't like he wasn't an object. I wasn't trying to be generous or be a good person in his eyes or for anybody. It was just like this thing that I did. And then it was over, and I went on with stuff. So, what is it like when we don't live an about life, about something? Live more directly. So many of us, I feel, including myself, the center of gravity of how we live our life is in the stories and ideas in our cognitive world, the stories of our thoughts and our ideas. And what we learn, I think, in part, through sitting and seeing very clearly what's going on, is that that's only part of the story. And if you see it's only part of the story, we can see there's actually much more that's going on in the present moment than our particular thoughts and ideas. And then rather than referencing our life in those thoughts and those ideas, we can reference our life in this bigger picture of what's going on. And if we're in a bigger picture of what's going on, it's not a world of objects anymore. It's my proposal, it's my experience. So there's this ideal of the bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva is an ideal of a person whose life is related to awakening, to a world which is not based on objects of separation. And we say that one of the definitions of no self in Buddhism is that there's no separate self. It isn't that you have to kind of get it. If you say it that way, then we don't get caught up in this, you know, what is a self? And I have a self, and my therapist says I have a self, and my therapist tells I'm supposed to have a better self, or a stronger sense of self, and here you're telling me I have no self, I'm confused, and you know. But there's no separate sense of self as a good definition of anatta. There's no sense of inherent separation between me and the tree, and me and you, and what's going on. The idea of inherent separation and being totally independent is kind of an illusion. And so to find out, and that's what we find when we become awakened, we explore the world of awakening, we find that there is no inherent separation. So from this no sense of inherent separation, the bodhisattva is a person who wants to live that experience. And maybe doesn't necessarily live it moment by moment, but is inspired by that possibility of being awakened and wants to orient their life by the possibility of that awakening. But not just for themselves, not some individual enlightenment, but really they see that possibility, that potential in other people and other beings also. They see that other people have that ability to live a life that's not objectful. It's not, you know, that's not full of fear or ambition or worry or self-defense or projection or all the different ways it's about things rather than just being things. And so the bodhisattva is someone who's inspired by this possibility of freedom of awakening in the world. But they don't necessarily only focus on themselves. This is where it's going to happen. They see that it's possible, all, you know, they want it to happen in the world and around them, everywhere, including themselves. It's said that the bodhisattva ideal is an altruistic ideal, that it's an ideal of someone who is dedicated to be of service to other people. And it is a kind of service-oriented ideal. And I think it's one of the great, you know, I think it's one of the great ideals that we have in, as human beings. And I'm struck, you know, how much the I don't know if they're role models, but the pop figures, the people we look up to in our society, you know, there's, you know, sometimes politicians, sometimes not, maybe more often these days not. Sometimes I wish they were role models. Athletes, the Michael Jordans of the world, and entertainers. Entertainers have become, you know, these great icons in our culture. The Michael Jacksons and the Madonnas or whatever. And I, you know, maybe that's a little bit okay, but But what about the people like Desmond Tutu and Aung San Suu Kyi and Dalai Lama and Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi? These are, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, those are all those people are bodhisattvas. And, you know, they're inspiring people. And why aren't they more in the limelight? Why don't they get as much attention and much inspiration in our culture as the people who, you know, make $2 million because they can make more basket shots than I can? So the ideal. So the ideal is one of service, of being of help to other people. But it's not only that. It's just simply because it's not only that, because it's not an ideal which it creates separation. It's about separation. So it's as much about the suffering that goes on in here as it is the suffering that goes on out there. A bodhisattva meets suffering wherever it is. And in a sense, I believe that the traditional arhat ideal of Buddhism and the bodhisattva ideal are really not that separate. And that if you don't live in the world of Buddhist mythology, they're inseparable from each other. That the bodhisattva ideal, the real distinction between a bodhisattva and an arhat in classic Buddhist teachings, in order to allow for the difference, you have to believe in an innumerable number of lifetimes and the mythology, the cosmology of many lifetimes. And, you know, maybe that's fine. I'm not going to debunk that or say that's not where it's at. But the traditional difference between the arhat and the bodhisattva is dependent on having that belief system in place. And if you're not so concerned about that being a central thing in how you can orient your life, then the difference between the arhat and the bodhisattva disappears, I say, entirely. And the arhat is as altruistic as a bodhisattva. But the bodhisattva, we say it more explicitly in the bodhisattva ideal. And what's said more explicitly is that the bodhisattva is really of service to the world around him or her. And I think it's natural that anybody who begins waking up begins having a sense of that we're participating in this whole show together, that there is no inherent separation between my suffering and your suffering, my joy and your joy, that we meet the joys and the suffering as it is in the world, and we respond to it. So, you know, if our dedication is to free the world of suffering and to help the world wake up, you do your own homework, say, and you've managed to free yourself of suffering, you know, great. But then you're sensitive. And what you're sensitive to? You're sensitive to a tremendous amount of suffering in the world around us. And, well, the practice is the same. You've dedicated yourself to practice, so practice is forever. Because even, say, you've managed to clean your own act up, there's a lot more cleaning up out there that needs to happen. So we say that in the bodhisattva ideal, we make explicit the idea that practice is forever. It isn't something that you kind of reach an end and then it's done. The arhat ideal, it kind of looks more like, oh, you've come to an end, that's done. And they say in the arhat ideal, done is what had to be done. So you can, you know, go to Florida and go on vacation, you know. You've done what had to be done. But done what had to be done is what's done is all the separation, all the barriers. And then once that's done, what's left, all that it possibly could be left is to be of service, is to be of help. And to be a bodhisattva. I think all arhats are bodhisattvas. I can't imagine it can be any other way. So the ideal of a bodhisattva is someone whose practice is not simply oriented just for themselves and for their own well-being. And for me personally, I feel like I'm on the bodhisattva path. That's my ideal that I've kind of oriented my life to. And I've taken bodhisattva vows, in a sense, in the Zen tradition. And it's very interesting to me that most American Vipassana teachers have taken bodhisattva vows. And here we're in this, you know, Theravada tradition where usually we don't think that's part of the tradition. And some of them, you know, think they've kind of left the tradition to do that. But Bodhisattva is ideal as part of Theravada tradition as much as anything else. But what it means for me personally is that I guess the important meaning for me is that my own particular well-being, my own particular spiritual development and progress and experiences and realization and all that, I'm concerned that I don't have to say this exactly, but it's an equal footing with the well-being of other people and the enlightenment, the well-being, the freedom, the spiritual development of others. And so I'm not going to put myself and my own well-being at the forefront of what has to happen. There are times where it's very important. I do put it in the forefront and I go on retreat and do things. But that it's not the only show in town. And that I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to be preoccupied with holding on to my spiritual development or how I develop myself or my own states of mind at the expense of being able sometimes to be of service and help to other people. And so I'm not going the fast track here, you know, to get fully, totally enlightened. Because I'm very interested as a bodhisattva in all of us kind of, in some way sense, all of us are in the boat together and we're all kind of working on this together to become free. And so to be of service, to be helpful to other people, to create a space where other people can practice and be introduced to Buddhism is as important for me as my own practice. So there's a tension between the two, in a sense, it's all too easy to only be of service and get all stressed out and lose any touch with one's own practice and one's well-being and health. And we have to be careful not to go too far. One has to include oneself. If we're going to save all beings, you have to include yourself. Otherwise, it's dangerous. And what happens is people, sometimes who have the bodhisattva vow, forget about themselves. And then there are some practitioners who forget about the rest of the world. And where the balance is everybody has to find for themselves. There's no right balance. There is no right person who's the model of how we're supposed to do this. There are times when it's appropriate to spend many years really focusing just on oneself and one's own spiritual practice. And then it's appropriate for many years to forget about oneself and really be of service, humble servant, doing things for other people. And I think it arises out of practice, knowing what you need to do if you're mindful. I spent a lot of time, my first year in the Zen monastery at Tassajara, reflecting on my desire or my motivation to be of service in the world, to try to be helpful to other people. And it felt to me that, what happened was I didn't trust it. I didn't trust people who wanted to be of service. I thought, well, you know, it's probably self-serving and probably ambitious and, you know, it's for their own identity or whatever. Somehow I had some misgivings about it. So I spent a year reflecting about what was my motivation, my intention, to live a life that was trying to be of service and helpful to other people. And after a year of reflection, I felt that it was an exploration of this topic. I felt that it was possible to have a motivation to be of service that wasn't self-serving. So that was, nice. I was pretty glad to discover that. So then, it's one thing to discover that's possible. It's another thing to discover how to do it. And maybe that's, practice is forever. And that's, part of, for me, the Bodhisattva ideal, it's practice never stops. Because if you're not practicing for yourself, then you're practicing, in a sense, for others, without any sense of others being different than you. So my, buying this guy his cheeseburger, I wasn't being generous when I did that with him. I just did it. And And there were a lot more homeless people on University Avenue that day. And so it's, you know, so I could have just gone, kept going down the street and feeding these people, you know. I didn't. But you know, you get the sense it's forever. It doesn't stop. You know, you can't. There's no end to a spiritual practice. It might get easier. It might be easier to buy people their sandwiches or whatever. But it doesn't stop. It just means there's more people. There's more. The world is, you know, there's five billion people now. And how many more minutes do you have in your life? it's you know, so it's forever. So we can relax. Some people have pointed out the Bodhisattva ideal traditionally is an ideal which is supposed to take three innumerable kalpas to fulfill. And a kalpa is how much time it takes if a bird flew by a granite block that was 1 mile cube, 1 mile by 1 mile, 1 mile. And once every 100 years, this bird flew by and brushed its feather against this cube. A kalpa is how long it takes for that cube to wear down to nothing. So there's three innumerable of these. You know, not just, you know, one of these, but so a very long time is a kalpa. So three of these innumerable numbers of these is how long it takes for a bodhisattva to become a Buddha. Because that's what the goal is for bodhisattvas, to finally become a Buddha. Yes?
It's longer than the known universe.
And so it's pretty long. But one of the ideas that people have, mostly scholars, is that to put the context of your spiritual path in such a huge cosmological frame means that you can a little bit relax about your own efforts and where you're going, what you're going to attain. But you don't want to relax so much that you put it off either, which is what some Buddhists have done. Well, it doesn't really matter what I do this lifetime. Next lifetime, I'll get on with it. And so it becomes an excuse not to practice. And that you don't want to do that either. But you don't want to also get caught up, I mean, you know, and the great significance of, you know, anything, you know, where you're going and what you're attaining. You relax. You do the best you can. You practice the best you can, as honestly and sincerely as you can. And you trust everything else. You trust the universe. So the Bodhisattva ideal is one to be of service and to include other people as part of our practice, so that our practice is not insulated. And I think there's a lot of wisdom to this. Morris Friedman said, "We cannot find reality simply by remaining with ourselves or making ourselves the goal. Paradoxically, we only know ourselves when we know ourselves responding to others." And I think there's a lot of wisdom to the Bodhisattva ideal in the sense that we are simply not independent individuals. And so if you're trying to liberate yourself as an independent individual or make yourself better as an independent individual, it's hopeless. And you only really find, I don't know if you find yourself, but you really only really find reality. Not necessarily only in service. It isn't like you have to go out and join a soup kitchen. But you only find reality in our interdependent existence. If you don't sense and feel an interdependent existence, you don't find even yourself. So that's why Sylvia Boorstein, she says, it's a lot easier to dedicate your life to the liberation of all beings than it is to liberate yourself, because you don't exist. To liberate, you know, something that doesn't exist is a lot more difficult than liberate, you know, all these other beings. So rather than thinking that the Bodhisattva ideal is this huge, exhausting task, it's actually, you know, maybe the only thing we can do. And there's this scripture that I'm studying from a dissertation, which is one of the earliest Buddhist sutras on the Bodhisattva path. Someone says, you know, isn't this Bodhisattva path really difficult? You know, it's three innumerable kalpas, and it's all the suffering, and you're doing all this. You know. And the Buddha says, anybody who has a notion of difficulty is not a bodhisattva. That if you think that that you're engaged in difficult practice or difficult activity, you've gotten caught up in aboutness, in objectifying the situation, and there's no difficulty in being, you know, in it's just what's happening, and we're back at the actual. What is the actual? What is our relationship to the actual? So the Bodhisattva path, one of the important elements of it, in the kind of usual formulation of it, is something that's called the Bodhisattva vow, the idea of a vow. And that's something which is very little part of the Vipassana scene, talking about vows. Partly, I guess, because we focus so much on the actual rather than the ideal. But even in Vipassana, there are vows that sometimes get resolves that are part of the practice. Usually a teacher knows the right time to suggest it, the resolves. But the Bodhisattva vow is... the idea of a vow, as I understand it, the wholesome part of it, I've seen lots of people beat themselves up and suffer a lot because of vows. But the idea of a vow is that is to have some sense of what who we are, some possibility of what's possible for us ourselves, some possibility of awakening, of interconnectedness, of being of service, or whatever. Feeling this is really feeling this, maybe having had a taste of this, and really real intimate sense of this. This is, you know, who I am. And then a vow is a kind of a commitment, a stated commitment to oneself, that this is what I'm going to really make my life about. And there's a power to commitment, there's a power to vow that's a lot different than not vowing. Just like there's a power to knowing there's an ideal, to knowing what we have a potential, there's a different kind of power available to us than if we don't know that potential, don't know that possibility. And so if we never see or never are told about that possibility, we might always stay where we're at right now and really never develop that possibility. So the vow is to recognize there's a possibility, potential, and to have a stated commitment. This is, maybe even publicly, this is what I'm going to base my life on, or what I'm going to orient my life on. Not to be goal-oriented, not to be striving, not because this present moment isn't full the way it is, but this is a beautiful ideal. This is how I. This is who I really am. This is who I really want to be, or this is, I think more like that, this is who I am, actually. And I vow to live my life most fully from what I know is most true about myself and my interrelated, interactive reality that I live in. And so the Bodhisattva vow, the Bodhisattva lives on that vow. And so by stating it, it's like stating the precepts. You know, we take the precepts, we take refuge. It's acknowledging what's already here and what's already true for us, but it makes it so much more stronger for us by having done it, by doing this ritual, by doing this kind of thing. So the vow of Bodhisattva is a vow. It's a very important part of the Bodhisattva path, is to actually recognize most clearly for oneself what it is most important for one, what the deepest intention is for oneself, and then state it for oneself. You know, this is my vow. I vow to live a life dedicated towards awakening. I vow to live a life dedicated to the awakening of all beings. So the Bodhisattva vow is very ancient. Each Bodhisattva is supposed to make their own, but there is a formulaic one which is quite ancient, which is the way I know it, the translation I know best is the way they say it at the Zen Center. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them all, or liberate them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them all. And the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to enter it. And then there's a Zen teacher, I want to mention his name, but there's a Zen teacher whose favorite song is, or was, maybe it's Frank Sinatra who sang it, The Impossible Dream. Because he felt that it represented the Bodhisattva ideal. You know, it's impossible. It's impossible to save all beings. But so you relax and you just, you know, you do the best you can. So that's something, you know, it's an important part of my life, this ideal. And it's something that, you know, that explains a little bit the decisions I make at times for myself. I don't, the quality of my mind, of my concentration, of my heart, could be a lot better than it is. You know, it could be more calm, more subtle, have more equanimity. If I went off and sat endless retreats. But somehow that doesn't seem like where what's important and where it's at. And so there's a sacrifice, in a sense. I don't want to call it, that's not the right word. I didn't sacrifice, you know, my $1.70 for this guy's burger the other day. But that doesn't seem as important to me. It's important to have equanimity and have this, you know, settled mind. But that's not as important as it is to kind of help, you know, try to be helpful so other people can practice and have contact with the Dharma and practice and awakening. And so I sacrifice, in some sense, my own well-being at times for all this. But hopefully not too much, because if I have to sacrifice too much, then I can't be very helpful. So, you know, we all do it together. We practice together. So... the Bodhisattva path, the ideal. And I think you know, you don't have to, you know, whatever you think of this, I think it comes naturally from just doing practice itself. And I have a tremendous trust in the power of mindfulness practice, just in and of itself. Whatever needs to happen will happen on its own. You don't have to be caught up and worry about ideals and doing anything else but being mindful in the way that's appropriate for you at your this particular stage of your life. Maybe that's enough. Yes.
Why isn't the Buddha? Why isn't he continually reborn if he has so much compassion for suffering in the world? Why isn't he not coming back?
Because he's dead.
Control of the reincarnation.
I don't know. I mean, I can give you the doctrinal answers to all those questions, but that's just dogma. I don't know. I think it's mostly just mythology. And even the place where that question is coming from is mythology. I mean, there's a lot of presuppositions behind even being able to ask a question like that. So look at those presuppositions: nature of a Buddha, the nature of rebirth, the nature of, you know, all kinds of things. So, in order to liberate properly the custodian, we should also think of getting out of here at 5. The well-being of all beings. So, those of you who maybe came late, there's 2 dana baskets up there. One is for the rent. We hope that it's a donation. So, you know, but it would be nice if everybody contributed $5 to pay for the rent of the room. And there's another dana basket for the teacher. And there's Voices in Spirit Rock, if you want to buy a copy. And may the benefit and the merit from this day of practice together be for the benefit of all of you and for the benefit of all beings everywhere, so that all beings, may they be happy. Thank you.